Good evening, everybody, and welcome. I'm Jonathan Bray. I'm a director of the Urban Transport Group. This event tonight is part of a wider set of initiatives, including this report. It's called Making the Connections on Climate, How City Regions Can Join the Dots Between Transport, Energy and the Built Environment. This report zeroes in on these questions. Given the scale and urgency of the climate crisis, how do we break down the barriers between what we do on transport and what we do on energy? How do we break down the barriers between what we do on transport and the decarbonisation and adaptation of the built environment? How do we realise the synergies between these different sectors? And how do we remove the obstacles to making those synergies? And how do we get more of the inspiring and positive examples that we have highlighted in the report, and we'll hear more about from our speakers, about council homes that are heated by spare waste heat generated by London Underground, about trams and trains that are powered by green, clean, renewable energy, which is accountable to the citizens of the cities involved. How do we get more examples of disused land or existing transport infrastructure that's greener, that's been rewilded? How do we scale up? How do we speed up? What governance structures do we need to achieve that? Part of what we talk about tonight might be around, do we need more municipal control of utilities and transport if we're really going to crack on?
Yes.
And ultimately, how do we do all the right things on energy, on transport and the built environment? How do we do all the right things on those and do them all at the same time? Because that's what we need to do. So that's enough from me, because I can't wait to hear from the speakers. So I'm going to hand over to Philip to do the introductions.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. So also on behalf of LSE Cities and the LSE more widely, a big and warm welcome to tonight. I'm Philip Rode. I'm the Executive Director of LSE Cities, a research centre, as the name suggests, that is dedicated to the study of cities, global urbanisation and city change. This evening is really a wonderful new step for our collaboration with the Urban Transport Group, and once again an attempt of not just doing academic research but to engage with practice, with policy making and with doers on the ground. It also tonight coincides with LSE's Green Week, so that's extremely appropriate, because ultimately I think the concern we are all sharing on this panel is about the climate emergency and a context within which we need to extremely accelerate action on the ground. And with that, let me now come to the introduction of our distinguished panel. And I'll do this from your left to the right. Our first speaker will be Florian Bieberbach, who is Chief Executive Officer of Stadtwerke Munich. For the non-German speakers, that translates as something like Munich's multi-utility company. He graduated in computer science and management from Technische Universität Munich and holds a doctorate degree in economic science from that university, as well as an MBA in European utility management from Jacobs University in Bremen. Florian is president of CEDEC, the European Association of Local Energy Companies, and vice president of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry for Munich and Upper Bavaria. At the Technical University of Munich and its School of Public School of Management, he serves as a honorary professor for energy markets and is chairman of the Forschungsgesellschaft or Forschungsstelle für Energiewirtschaft, which is an energy research institution. Our second speaker will then be Juliet Davenport, who is founder and chief executive of Good Energy, and I think the name says it all, a renewable energy company with a mission to power a greener, cleaner future together with its customers. Julia has been an innovator for over 20 years, working on ideas to fight climate change and transform the energy sector for the better. In 2013, she was awarded an OBE for services to renewables. She's currently sitting on the board of the Renewable Energy Association and Innovate UK, and is vice president of the Energy Institute. In addition, she sits on advisory boards such as the leading UK think tank Energy System Catapults, Aurora, Oxford Energy, and also one of our other centres here at the LSE called the LSE's Grantham Research Institute on the Environment and Climate Change. We'll then have a third speaker, more responding to the two key presentations, but also then adding a particular perspective from the more particular context of UK cities. And our first speaker here is Rasita Chudasama, I hope I'm pronouncing that well, who has 15 years of experience of working within a transport planning and environment context in local government. She's the principal transport planner for Nottingham City Council and is heading up the city's ambitious 6.1 million Go Ultra Low Cities programme. Having previously developed Nottingham's transport policy through the local transport plan and more recently delivered the 16 million local sustainable transport fund programme aimed at promoting more walking, cycling and public transport use, Rasita is putting into action her skills in supporting a shift to low emission transport across Nottingham and the wider area. And last but not least, our local colleague from just up the road from Islington Council, Keith Townsend, who is a corporate director for environment and regeneration at Islington Council. He has worked as a senior leader in the public sector for many years and has significant experience of leading strategic operations while delivering borough investment programs and delivering service improvements and major projects. His responsibility also cuts across an inclusive economy, energy services, and delivering the council response to climate change. Previously, he was executive director of environment and customer service at Ealing Council, and Keith is currently acting as chief technical advisor to the West London Waste Authority and is a commissioner for the Mayor of London's Green Space Commission. So as you can see, we have a wonderful group of very diverse experts on this side, and I'm sure if we add then the expertise on your end of the room, this will be a very promising evening of engagement. So for now, I'd like to invite Florian to kick us off with a presentation which takes us to Munich.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell you a little bit about what we do in Munich. First of all, who is Stadtwerke München, SWM? You already mentioned it. The key thing and very specific thing also for Germany is that we are a fully integrated energy and transport company. Not only energy and transport, we also have telecommunications, drinking water and public pools, but that's not that relevant today. So we have one board of management responsible for all these fields, all integrated, and that has been the case for decades now. So we are a relatively old company, 120 years old, and for a bit more than 20 years we are organized now as a private company, GmbH in Germany, which is a limited basically in the UK, but the sole shareholder is the city of Munich. This is a very specific model. It's very interesting to discuss with hardcore economists because they say this doesn't exist in our textbooks. Are you a private company or are you public sector? Now we are something in the middle, a hybrid between public sector and private company. We are operating primarily in liberalized markets, in competitive markets. But it's, I think, for what we are talking about here, I personally believe this is a perfect model. I'm happy to go into the details later on, but now it's not enough time. So what do we do when it comes to climate action? I will first talk about what we do in energy, what we do in transport, and how we integrate all of that. So when it comes to energy, it's relatively simple. We have a target, you mentioned it already, to cover Munich's electricity demand 100% from renewable sources by 2025. This is not meant technically. It all comes from climate change policies of the city of Munich, so technically Munich will not build all these generation plants around Munich. That's not possible. Most of that is wind farms. They're actually all across Europe. But the idea of Munich was basically to compensate for all the electricity demand in Munich by building the same amount in renewable electricity production, at least within the European electricity grid. And our history was not that environmentally friendly. We started with a share of renewables below 5% in our portfolio. So historically, we were active in coal and gas, even nuclear. But now the share of renewables has gone up to more than 70%. So we are pretty confident that by 2025, we will be at the 100%. The second and even more challenging is that we want to convert the district heating system in Munich to renewable sources. Of course, heating is much more important than electricity when it comes to the amount of energy that you need. And this will be primarily based on geothermal energy. You see one geothermal plant here on the picture. So we will convert, and this really takes decades, to convert the district heating system primarily to geothermal energy. As for example, Paris does something very similar, and other cities. And the third point is something which is small but worthwhile mentioning, because it's not yet very common and not yet very known all across Europe, is the district cooling. Of course, climate change also means that there's more demand for cooling, and climate change is happening and has been happening for quite a while now. So we have seen in the last 10 years an increasing demand for cooling. And if you do all that cooling with traditional methods, the traditional machines that you have, much best known from American cities, that is, of course, terribly inefficient when it comes to energy consumption, terribly inefficient, and it creates terrible, very hot microclimates in the cities. So the idea is, how do you get rid of all the heat in the cities, how to get it out of the cities, and a district cooling network, which is basically the same like a district heating network, but you do not deliver hot water, but cold water, and you get it back warm. District cooling network is, I think, a key issue for cities in the future, and the more southern the cities are, the more important that is, and this is currently our fastest growing part of the energy business. So what do we do in transport? Probably nothing new to you. It's all pretty straightforward. The objective is here to fully electrify public transport in Munich by 2030, based on renewable electricity, of course. Otherwise, it's not really the benefit is very low if you do it on coal-based electricity. So it needs to be based on renewables. Of course, the second big target in Munich is to continuously shift the modal split to public transport. That's probably like in every other city. And of course, there will be remaining transport, and the target is to electrify as much of that as possible, primarily by building infrastructure, charging infrastructure in the city of Munich, in the streets, in parking spaces, whatever. So that are big programs partially funded by the city itself. One important thing, as we wanted to speak about housing and decarbonizing transport, of course, the density of population in the city is a key issue as well. It's very simple. The more density you have in the population, the easier it is for renewable technologies, and the easier it is for public transport, for decarbonized public transport. And Munich is seeing a lot of growth in a very limited area. Munich is a relatively small city when it comes to the area which is covered, and we see a lot of population growth, so the density increases, which is good for what we do. And part of the effort to shift the modal split is, of course, a lot of typical innovative things that probably all cities are testing, like the intermodal digital services, mobility platforms on the smartphones, or mobility hubs in the streets. On the left-hand side on the picture, you see a mobility hub or part of a mobility hub where you have a metro station and bike sharing and pedelec sharing and car sharing and all that integrated into one spot to make, to promote intermodal public transport. And of course, we are also working on these flexible new modes of transport based on sharing, ride-sharing, mobility on demand. You see in the middle one of these test electric, more or less autonomous buses who are designed to improve the flexibility in the less densely populated areas of the city, where you currently maybe have one bus going along a defined line coming about every 20 minutes, or late at night maybe every 40 minutes, which is not very convenient for people. And the idea is that you have these flexible buses taking you basically home at night in the future. We are just testing them. They are not working properly yet, of course. And how do we combine that? This picture is meant to show that a little bit. I mean, in the end, it's very simple. It's not rocket science. It's pretty straightforward. How do you combine all the public transport and all the green electricity? It's basically electricity. And I try to split that into various levels. The first and easiest is the energy capacities, the energy supply capacities. Electrifying public transport and transport in total just means you need more electricity. And if we want to convert Munich to renewable electricity, it just means that we need to build more windmills. It's as easy as that. What is interesting that our calculations say that the energy demand for the year will only increase by about 20% through electrification of transport in total. That's the numbers that we estimate by 2050. So this is not a big deal. It's not a big deal to produce 20% more or to generate 20% more electricity. The second is this is more challenging. Even in an integrated company like ours, which is pretty large, we have about 10,000 employees. And by the way, operations in the UK as well, so we're not only focused on Munich. It is very important to bring people together who are working in these various fields. And historically, the people responsible for the buses, maybe they knew the people who were responsible for electricity grids, but they didn't really speak to each other apart from maybe in the canteen or so. So there was no reason to have a lot of interaction between these departments. And now they need to speak to each other and need to learn to do their planning and operations as an integrated approach. And we do that based on virtual teams that we have in the company across electricity and transport. For example, about charging infrastructure, about whatever. That is a cultural change, and it's not something that just goes like this. The next level is city planning. We are now moving in Munich to the idea of integrated planning of all relevant infrastructure, which is, it's a bit embarrassing, even new to us. We are now an integrated company, or have been for more than 100 years. And now we start with the idea, couldn't we plan our infrastructure together? And the driver for that actually was electric buses. Because for the first time, we came to the conclusion that if you need electric buses, you need bus depots with a lot of charging infrastructure, high electricity demand. You need to technically plan that with the substations. You need a large substation there. Why don't we just do the planning together, an integrated approach? So now for the new quarters in Munich that are being developed, we are now technically planning charging infrastructure, bus depots, etc., all in one team, which is, as I said, new to us as well. But that is, I think that brings a lot of benefits that we don't all see at this moment. It's not only about reducing greenfield consumption because you put it all in one place. It's also about optimization of energy demand because you can make it much more efficient with an integrated approach. A very simple example is for a bus depot in winter, at least in Munich, you need to heat the place, even outside, to avoid freezing and things like that. In an integrated approach, you can use waste heat from power generation for whatever technical installation that you have on the electricity supply. And now we will use the waste heat from that, which would go to the atmosphere normally, to heat the place where the buses drive around in winter and where we don't want any snow or ice. So the more you integrate that and the more people speak to each other, the more ideas come up how to optimize energy consumption there as well. Of course, you have lower operational cost if you do an intelligent integrated approach, and it's even better for customer convenience because, for example, if you have that substation and you have the bus depot, it makes sense to have public charging infrastructure there as well for private electric vehicles. And when you do that in an integrated approach, it's not only cheaper, you can also think about where do people park and where does it make sense to put that. So I think we can also improve customer convenience. And the last level is then operations, when it comes to operations. And that, where we are working on here, is primarily to integrate the charging infrastructure, all the charging infrastructure, primarily for the buses, because they need a lot of electricity, to integrate it into our virtual power plant. So we operate and have been operating a virtual power plant for quite a while with all these small-scale electricity generation and industrial demand-side management, power-to-heat installation, things like that. Also, cooling makes a lot of sense in a virtual power plant. And integrating charging for buses into that power plant gives a lot of opportunities. Primarily the opportunity to charge cheaper and with less carbon. Cheaper means when power prices on the power exchange are low, immediately you increase the charging, the voltage for charging, or the watts. And if you have a peak in power prices, you just stop charging for maybe an hour or so. That makes a lot of sense, but also you can optimize it. When there's more wind energy in the system, you can charge more, and when there's more coal or nuclear or whatever in the system, you can reduce charging, it's very convenient that the ecological and economical aspect typically go together. So typically when there's a lot of renewables, a lot of wind in the system, the power prices are low as well. So when you optimize one side, the other is typically optimized at the same time. And the second thing is that you can also take into account requirements of the distribution grid. You can monitor your grid, and for example, if there's an overload in the grid, you can reduce charging for the buses for a while until this overload has gone away. So what we try is to optimize the capex for the grid to make sure we don't need to over invest into the grid because of unregulated charging all over the place. So intelligent charging solutions taking into account electricity prices and the status of the electricity grid saves a lot of money in cables and transformers and things like that. So that works pretty well. That is already working. This is not something in the future. This is something which works today, and we are quite happy about that, and we will try to scale that much more in the future. Okay, so my 15 minutes are over, and that's it. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Florian. That was an absolutely inspiring overview of what's happening on the continent. Juliet, if I may invite you to give your
talk. Good evening, everybody, and thank you for inviting me tonight. So that's quite a one to follow, because Munich obviously is a country, a city that's been looking at this for 100 years, integrated thinking, maybe catching up on some of the other integration. The UK is in an interesting position in comparison to that. And what I want to try and do for you tonight is to give you a vision of what we do as an organisation, company Good Energy, but also where we are as a marketplace, and what does that then mean for electrification of transport particularly. So I think it was touched on earlier, one of the core purposes of the business is to power the choice for cleaner, greener future together. And those words are very specifically chosen in that, one, we're an energy company, that's what we do. Secondly, we want to be part of giving consumers a choice. So this is about including consumers in this conversation. When I entered the energy market 20 years ago, I would quite often have conversations with some of the CEOs of the Big Six who don't really consider people as consumers, they consider them as meters. So as far as they're concerned, their job is to get the power as far as the meter, and what happens the other side is somebody else's problem. And there continues to be, I still see this attitude that nobody can influence what happens on the other side of the meter, and actually the other side of the meter will never change. And I think that is a fundamental underestimation of humanity, first of all, but also of what technology in terms of a change of behavioural can actually do. And I hope I'll show some of that today. In terms of cleaner and greener, one of the reasons we use both of those is because we are a renewable energy company. We've always been 100% renewable on our electricity side. But we're also interested in associated technologies. So that includes electric heating, that includes battery storage, that includes EV charging. So we want to look at the whole piece rather than just kind of the renewable side. And together is that What we actually here to do is to empower individuals to be part of this conversation, be part of the solution on climate change, not just be at the end of the meter. So this tries to show you what's happened over the last 20 years. So when I set up Good Energy 20 years ago, the UK was generating about 98% of its energy from non-renewable sources. So mainly nuclear, coal, gas, all very large production. Over the last 20 years, there's been a massive shift on the electricity side to go to 40% of our electricity is now generated by renewable energy. And that's hugely fast, first of all. One of the things about renewables, it can deploy fast. We can implement it. You can implement a solar park in sort of 3 months, a wind farm you can build in 6 months. I think Hinkley is going to take a little longer than that. So what's interesting about it is it's quite a disruptive technology in that sense. And what we've seen particularly is the networks and the existing infrastructure in this country be slightly surprised by what has happened. And in particular, the next part is that when we entered the market, there were about 58 generators in the UK. And quite often what you'd do is if you wanted to change the power output, you'd make the National Grid make a phone call, ring somebody up and ask them to switch something on. We've now got nearly 1 million people generating power in the UK, and that can range from very large power stations to people who've got solar panels on their roofs. And so that completely changes the makeup of this market and how it operates. And we find that really exciting because our view of people who generate power, we see them as customers in the same way. Quite often they don't do it as part of their main job. They do it as a sideline or part of their household or something like a business. But they are a really important part, for me, of what can happen in this marketplace. And so we've always been a company. We actually are a company who have more people who generate their own power than actually we sell to. And that means that we look at this business model and the way that we operate in a completely different way from any typical supply company. I got a call from one of my other CEO mates in the energy sector the other day who'd met one of the big CEOs who was terribly excited because it had got cold and he was going to be selling more gas. That is a very old-fashioned approach to this market, in my view. We shouldn't be celebrating when customers' bills go up. What we should be celebrating is when they can actually control their bills, when they can actually generate their own power, and when we can help them do that. In terms of the clean energy grid, what this is going to mean is that the grid is going to have to change. So our infrastructure is fundamentally going to be changing. And I'm going to touch on that as probably one of the biggest barriers we see to electrification. Partially because we estimate, it's probably much less than this, that we probably use our grid at about a 50% capacity, if that. So what that means is that there is a lot of space on it. But the way that we've thought about how we use our grid infrastructure in the UK is that we don't expect the people on the other side of the meter to respond to behavioural change. So we expect them all to do everything they've always done. And part of the reason for that, how many people here know when the peak hours on the trains are? I know, yes. Okay. How many do you know when the absolute peak hours in our electricity market is? Okay. And that is because we've never been told. We've never been part of that conversation. We've never been included to try and help the system change. And that, I guess, is what I'm passionate about, is trying to make sure that we can actually support people who want to either change their behaviour, invest in technology, invest in energy efficiency, to actually impact both climate, but also long-term their bills. And so that, for me, is a kind of vision of where this marketplace and what's really exciting. Right now, we're in a big fight because, actually, everybody's caught up with the fact that this is quite a disruptive market right now in the UK, and they're desperately trying to hold on to all the assets and their business models that they've always had. In terms of what we do and why we're slightly different, we've always traded 100% renewable. And what that means is that we understand what it means for a country to look 100% renewable. And what's quite interesting is I have quite a lot of conversations with academics who talk to me about, particularly energy academics, who talk to me about the fact we're going to use interseasonal storage because we've got lots of offshore wind. And you kind of go to them, yeah, but if you put solar in with wind, actually it works very well. because when it's not windy, it tends to be sunny and vice versa. And actually, you don't need in-seasonal storage. What you need is inter-week storage, which looks very different. And so having this overview of a system, of what it looks like and how it behaves, really kind of helps you think about what are the real challenges. Because one of my challenges to energy research funding at the moment is it's very siloed. It tends to look at technology, tends not to look at behavioural research as well as technology together, and it definitely is not great on systems thinking. And that is one of the things I think we're really missing in energy research. And one of the things I hope that we're going to start to see shift, because we need to, from my point of view, you have to look at the beginning, you have to consider research is where we think about things, we understand systems, we look at technologies, we look at behavioural. We then look at innovation, where we take some of those technologies and that behavioural research, and we create business models around it and implement that. And then you look at the regulatory side, and you try and understand actually what's the regulatory structure that allows that to flourish in it. And then you look at the consumer side, who actually then pulls that as a demand. And you need the whole thing to work together to actually make it work. And whether that's energy or transport or heat, it doesn't matter. You've got to get it all working together. And that's what we try and do. I don't say we do it perfectly, but part of the reason why I have a team who are deeply knowledgeable about renewables, how you connect it, how you trade it, how you look after it. But also we do a lot of energy research, so we've just finished doing something on grid, vehicle-to-grid charging. So how do you support the energy grid in the UK with electric vehicles? Because we're going to be close to 1 million electric vehicles in a couple of years' time in the UK. That's going to be 1 million batteries driving around. Now, if we've got a shortage in the power market, why wouldn't you actually support that with an electric vehicle rather than the other way around? So we've been looking at that. That looks really viable. It could save customers £300 a year, we reckon, but the regulation is in the way at the moment, except for fleets, actually, so that might be an opportunity for some people. But what's interesting is that you can do this research and then you can find that what the next barrier is to really try and pull that through. And then we partner with a lot of people. So what we see at the moment is there's some new entrants into the green market, partially because they're being pushed by their shareholders. So some of the very large oil companies are coming in and buying a lot of companies. We tend to work in partnership. We like small innovative companies coming to us with ideas to really think about. That means that we can try and offer our customers really a kind of, I'm not saying we're the Apple, but the kind of Apple approach. So we provide a platform and then people can bring ideas and technologies to that so that we can support that with our customers. And for me, that's the kind of model that can move much faster once you could get some of the institutional parts out of the way. And one of the other businesses that we recently invested in, actually, they were originally a partner and then we invested in, was something called ZapMap. I don't know. If people have electric vehicles, you might have heard of it. It's the biggest mapping service in the UK of all the electric charging points. And it basically, if you buy an electric vehicle, it means that you can actually work out where you can charge it. And that, what we're doing is supporting that so that that could provide interoperability between charging points. Right now, you have to have 4 or 5 cards if you wanted to travel from here to John O'Groats to be able to charge at lots of different charging points. What's interesting about this marketplace is it's still at this early stage in terms of how do you actually get it to work properly. So I think in terms of the real challenges for the EV market as we see it is the new records, registrations have hit records for last things, partially driven by the new Tesla model, which is in a price range that's much better, partially driven by people realising that running electric vehicles is about a third the cost of running a petrol or a diesel car. So the actual cost of running it is far lower. About 1 million we expected by 2020. We reckon it's going to be 10 million by 2030. That's going to put a lot of pressure on the existing infrastructure. And we are now at a 10,000 EV charger milestone was hit in October. So you can see this market is evolving very fast. But what's classic with a fast thing, evolving market, is some of the infrastructure that's already in place desperately trying to catch up. So we're already seeing quite a resistance. So I spoke recently at something called the Low Carbons Networks Conference, where basically all the large infrastructure companies were. So you have National Grid, local distribution companies. And these guys are really struggling with how do they face this. They're trying to, their business model is essentially the more money they spend, the more money they get. And that doesn't really work. I love the concept of an efficient capital model, is that actually what we should be looking at with EVs, and there's a real opportunity with electric charging particularly, is can we charge them at different times of day so that we actually use the infrastructure more effectively and don't need to build more? Because most people don't need to charge at the peak period. The peak period is the 4 months in the winter when it's dark between 5 and 7, because most people come back and put a cup of tea on. But you don't need to charge your car then. It can wait till later on to charge, because most people can fully charge their car overnight. But the moment, the mentality is, and I've heard this, oh, when we connect somebody, we have to allow them to charge at any time. Now, that just seems ridiculous to me. Why don't we just do a different connection that you can't charge at those times unless you've got an emergency? So automatically, the vehicles have huge control mechanisms. They're so smart. But we're not thinking really creatively. And we've still got this kind of old-fashioned thinking sticking us there. And what we're finding now is you've got whole swathes of the country that are refusing to connect electric vehicle charging points, which means that we're just going to slow this down from a rollout. And so from my point of view, I think the real challenge in the UK is to start to make this whole market work. And I think you're going to have to start with slightly reshuffling government in terms of the way that it looks at things. So government right now has a regulator who looks after customers, which is absolutely fine. But the trouble is they're not looking after the customer's future. And actually, they're not thinking about the low carbon future as well. So at the moment, we've got a regulator who's stuck. They don't know how to unravel this. They work with a load of monopoly organisations who are trying to maximise capital, who aren't thinking about efficiency. And for me, at the other end of this, we've got research that really isn't thinking really holistically and from a whole systems approach enough to be able to solve this problem. So those are just some of the problems we're seeing at the moment. Those are the immediate ones we see. But they're completely solvable. It's just about taking time and effort and actually organisations coming together to point out there's a better way, which is great. Why, looking at the Munich model and understanding, actually, if you think about an integrated model, whether you do it within one company or whether you do it through a regulatory approach, actually, that is a much more effective way forward. I think I'm going to leave it there. I think that's my last slide. No, this is the last slide. So the challenges are, for every... One of the other things I think is quite interesting is that distribution networks are also very worried about people generating power in their own homes. So when people put solar panels on their roof, they use less power. So they use less capacity on the network and they pay network companies less money. But in reality, if you look at the future, if we're going to get 10 million electric vehicles on the systems, we're going to be using networks more, not less. So let's think about this in a clever way and allow more generation in people's homes and businesses and allow that to integrate better with our systems that we need on electric vehicles. Unlock some of the V2G is vehicle to grid. Unlock some of the potential of these electric vehicles through the regulation. And one of the things I'm really passionate about is open data. My personal view is we should be asking for all the distribution networks to release all their data so that new companies, innovators, local authorities can understand what's going on in there and people can come up with new ideas how to solve these problems for these old companies. Now, I think that really is my last slide. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And if I can ask all my fellow panelists to join me up front. So the way we want to continue with these two really inspiring insights and perspectives is to ground this in the reality of local government in the UK. And we're doing that by also going to two councils which arguably are leading in terms of what is possible. Maybe not as much at the moment as we have seen in Munich, but there is a lot of innovation happening regardless of the institutional constraints we have. And so let's kick this off with Rasita and for the case of Nottingham, which is a leader. If you want to sort of combine what you've heard with also your, of course, innovations on the ground, please.
Sure. Thank you very much. Really insightful presentations, actually. Quite inspiring. And I think for me personally, sort of some of the things that you said really resonated with some of the practical challenges that I'm facing in what I do on the ground in Nottingham. And, yeah, it's quite... quite frustrating, but also liberating to hear that actually I'm not the only one who's suffering there. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is about this whole integrated approach, and the fact in Munich you've got the opportunity because of the municipal company, which to some extent Nottingham is one of the most municipal local authorities, that we still own our own bus company. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have full control over what they do. They operate as an arm's length. They have their own board, they make their own decisions and their own investment decisions particularly, and sometimes that conflicts with what the city wants overall. We've got Nottingham City Homes, which is another municipal company that the authority owns, that manages our social housing stock, about 20,000 homes. Again, it's the point I'm trying to make is that it requires collaboration, it requires partnership, sometimes on a voluntary basis, because we don't have the same shareholders or board members sort of dictating what we do, which makes it quite a challenging but also interesting sector, because we all have to sort of get behind the same vision and come together and to achieve the same goal. Regulation, what you said, Juliet, about specifically DNO level for me. So Nottingham City Council's got a vehicle to grid project that we're currently trying to roll out with our own fleets. So we've purchased 40 vehicle to grid compatible Nissan vans. They are arriving now as we speak in batches. We're currently going to procurement for our battery and our vehicle to grid charging units themselves. When we had the conversation with the DNO about the existing supply to quite an old fleet depot, they said, right, you need an upgrade. It's going to cost you £800,000, which we hadn't forecasted for, because their response was, well, all of these things, the vehicles, the battery, your solar panels and your charging units, are all going to be energy generators. And so you need a 1.5, I think, kVA or megawatt, I can't remember the units, actually, connection to that depot, which actually made... potentially made the whole scheme unviable, and we could not challenge it. We just had to pay for it, basically, knowing that actually what we're trying to do is to take our whole depot and its operations off the grid. So the regulatory system and trying to, as a city, trying to have that conversation, a sensible conversation at a strategic level, I think is long overdue, because it's just we can't carry on the way that we've been going.
This is very good, and I want to very quickly come back to Florian, because we have now heard twice the issue of regulatory frustrations. Is this something which you are confronted with, or are you entirely free of German-wide, top-down, maybe quite ignorant regulatory interventions in your business?
Now, unfortunately, the regulators all across Europe are very well synchronized, so they all create the same trouble for people working in the field. Their approaches are all very similar. Of course, we have all these challenges as well, but it's a bit easier when you talk about that in the same company. I mean, literally, it is in the board of Stadtwerke München. The person responsible for public transport sitting next to him is the person responsible for electricity. And if there's a challenge, he just speaks to his colleagues and says, let's try to find a solution on that. That is, of course, much easier compared to a situation where this is a company, especially a nationwide company, where you need people to speak to, etc., and they maybe are not interested and are not listening. But the regulation issue is the same problem as it is here.
Thank you. So let's come to London. Keith, we spoke about, 33 different units of local government, and they all contributing at least with the same ambition, maybe having difficulties with getting to the same results of rapid decarbonization. But there's a lot of things happening, and I guess it's fair to say Islington is one of the leading ones.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to think so, but I would say that. But I've been at Islington for about 3 months, so I can claim very little credit, but I will claim credit in this great audience. Just picking up on the points that colleagues have said here, Florian, you talked about the governance model. I think there is a, for me, I think there is a renaissance in local government in London, around a renaissance in municipalism. And actually, it's going back to what local government was set up for in the first place. And I'm quite proud to work with an organisation that has a political leadership that's prepared to do that. And go into innovative space. And actually, I think there is an opportunity in London to do that more. And whilst there are challenges of having 33 London boroughs, well, 32 plus the City of London, which is a story into itself, plus Transport for London, plus the government, having said that, it's such a large space, and our combined power and the number of citizens we represent are huge in a very concentrated area. So I think there's massive opportunities there. Mm. We too are working on vehicle-to-grid opportunities because we're desperately trying to green our fleet at a rapid rate of knots. I think picking up on some of the points that Juliet raised, there is also a fundamental behavioural change shift here that we are grappling with in our sector. It's not only the shift in the organisations that Juliet's talking about, different thinking in some of the organisations that are both involved in energy and transport, but also about shifting our citizens' behaviour. Now, at the moment, we're riding a bit of a crest of a wave, about climate emergency. Most boroughs in London have declared a climate emergency and a rapid response to that. It's politically in vogue at the moment, and I think we have to be nimble to exploit that and the opportunities that go with that. I'm fortunate to be part of a London-wide network that I've chaired of me and my equivalents for 4 years. And actually, we are collaborating with our politicians to come up with some policy statements about what we think it could be our collective response to climate change, including transport and energy, involving politicians. And I think that's giving us the confidence in London local government to actually spell out some asks of the government nationally, whomever that may be on the 13th of December, because everybody's fighting to be more green than everybody else at the moment, and we may as well exploit that. But actually, does that give us an opportunity to release funding through the tax regime to help us for sustained investment? Because one of the challenges I see around that Florian referred to is about how do we retrofit our old building stock in the capital to be energy efficient? You know, there's some challenges there. Just the area, the example I wanted to focus on is a municipal energy generation project that Islington has been leading on, using quite simple technology, and it capitalises on the point that Florian raised about heat and cooling. We are actually building a second energy centre in Islington called Bun Hill. Innovatively called, it's Bun Hill 2, because we had a Bun Hill 1. So it's not that innovative in terms of name, but the innovation in there is based on its simplicity. We're drawing heat from the underground network. We're combining that traditional combined heat and power to effectively join to our original local energy network so that we can supply between 1,300 and 1,500 both municipal homes and private homes, which helps the economic model. And that technology, of course, allows us to flip it the other way, which I'm assuming is a big dial that says cold, that means that we can actually cool the underground in the summer as well. So there's mutual benefit here in terms of carbon reduction, in terms of cost reduction. And we know in our aspirations there could be at least 6 or 7 other locations in our borough alone that could replicate that model. I've simplified 10 to 15 years' worth of innovation, project nightmare, bureaucratic hell and funding challenges in 2 minutes. But actually, in February of next year, we will prove it will work because that's when it is opened and will start generating energy. So I think we've got a model that could be replicated and we're really excited to be pioneering that. Hence why I think that we're in a municipal renaissance in our sector. But actually there are loads and loads of barriers to overcome, but there are loads of opportunities as well.
Thank you very much, Keith. And I want to use what you said, which is quite powerful, about the return to to the level of the municipality to ask Juliet about how that resonates with her. I mean, we have three colleagues who in the end are advocating for a level that's sandwiched in between your concern and your work with the individual consumer, and then ultimately being a national or a nationwide organization, and of course providing renewable energy. There's a case that's being made, directly or indirectly, that the level of the city, the level of the local government, of maybe even the metropolitan region, is a particularly good one to advance renewable energy and to advance the integration we have been talking about. Do you buy this? Is this something that you detect the logic?
So I think it depends on the capability and the real advantage of the particular municipality. So each municipality will look different. They're not all the same. They have different resources. They have different capabilities. Where we've seen, so we work with about 130 social housing and local authority organisations who kind of, over the last 5 years, put solar into their tenants' roofs. And we kind of do the services and look after the integration of that. So they put the capital up, they learn the income, they deliver zero cost energy to their tenants, so they've actually reduced their tenants' bills. And then we look after it. And that for me is a great synergy, because we're good at that. We actually deployed our teams up to go and sort all the data out originally, make sure they were all set up properly, and we just simplify that. So for me, I think there are synergies between both models, and I think what you need to look at is where is the most effective. So my personal view is that I think particularly networks and where you've got infrastructure. So electricity networks, if those could look to be more municipal and more better, well thought through, I think that's, for me, that's the oldest structure in the UK that's broken right now. Now, but there are other ways of doing it. I mean, if you set the criteria for it, I mean, like any organisation, organisations are going to collaborate better if you set them up with the right criteria to operate. So a bus company will have, it probably has its own pieces that doesn't necessarily link it back to the organisation. If you can link them, then you can set them up so they can operate better. But you can also set them up so they can operate separately and they don't have to be under the same ownership. So I think my personal view is I think I'm up for lots of different models, and you use the most appropriate model in the right places.
Thank you. Any reactions to that? Is that...
Yeah, I mean, in Nottingham, I'd say back in 2015, I spent a year bidding to government for the Gulchalo programme, and we were one of the lucky ones to actually win the money to then be able to implement certain measures. And our team's motto has been work with the willing, because ever since we've won that money, you know, we've been convinced of it, that we're actually onto the right thing. We need to encourage electric vehicle take-up amongst our business community, members of the public, our internal organisations and fellow organisations. But sometimes you're knocking on a brick wall and you just have to move on from it. But we cannot keep waiting for people to wake up and realise there has to be some hard conversations that need to happen. And usually it comes down to who puts the bill for this stuff. Where does the regulation compel somebody to actually make a change versus waiting for them to actually decide to do the right thing? So for me, myself, I got an electric vehicle as a result of my programme, because I was driving around in a diesel car. I thought, how can I have any credibility and tell other people, look, you need to change your behaviour, get an EV, it's the right thing to do, if I wasn't living and breathing it myself and actually put myself in the shoes of an EV driver and the challenges that they face, the fact that you need to have all these RFID cards and smartphone apps to be able to connect to a network. It's fragmented, you know, so that's kind of my observation on what you were saying.
Florian, you wanted to...
Yeah, I wanted to explain why I think the municipal level makes more sense than historically for what we are talking about. Historically, for energy, there was a one-size-fits-all approach basically in all countries. There was a standard distribution grid for electricity, a standard gas grid, a standard power plant, coal-fired power plant, nuclear power plant. That was all standardized and basically the same in all countries, etc. And it worked well because it was efficient, using economies of scale, etc. Now when we move to the new world of renewables, there are not so many one-size-fits-all approaches anymore that exist. Of course, solar PV is a positive example. Solar PV is just working everywhere, basically, even in Norway. So solar PV is one thing that you can just roll out over the country. But when it comes to integrating sectors like heat and electricity and transport and cooling, etc., you need to take into account the local specificities. For example, when it comes to cooling, Copenhagen uses the sea. When it comes to heating, we use geothermal energy, which is specific for Munich. We use geothermal energy in the future also to produce cold in summer, because we do not have a sea or something like that that we can use. So when it comes to all the and the housing is different in every city, and so you need different technologies. So the more you want to optimize the whole system, the more you want to integrate all these sectors, the more you have to take into account what is very specific in that very city. And that is, I think, why the one-size-fits-all approaches by national companies doesn't work anymore, because they are not so good in rolling out very specific solutions in every city, because they don't have the local knowledge, etc. So this is why I think we will see even more a renaissance of municipalities or very small local private companies becoming more and more active in energy supply and integrating the sectors. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I mean, Keith, what's very specific about Islington? I want to come back to maybe the most intriguing figure I heard from Florian, which is that you calculated it's only 20% increase in electricity you need to entirely electrify mobility in Munich. Was that correct? Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in whether these are figures you are working with as well. You know, what would it mean in Nottingham or Islington? But beyond that, where do you think is something highly contextual, very specific to an inner London borough and very specific to a city like Nottingham?
I guess an interesting context point is looking at inner London, there is a reliance on public transport. So actually you're pushing at a behavioural change open door. And actually Islington has relatively low car usage, I think, in terms of car ownership rather. It is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, local authority in the country in terms of ownership. I think it's partly to do peculiarity, partly to do because we are blessed with good public transport in London. So that does give us a unique opportunity. But actually what we are finding is that our residents are telling us very strongly, which our political leadership have remarkable antennae of what residents are saying, that saying they want us to act and they want us to act really quickly. And therefore that's giving confidence to politicians locally to be really quite radical in their approach and not apologise for being radical for it. And I think that's sort of self-perpetuating, and that's really positive, I think, because that's a big barrier to overcome. And I think that's something I've noticed a difference coming from an outer London borough to an inner London borough. I've noticed that is a marked difference. So you're pushing at an open door in terms of behavioural change, mm-hmm. and an expectation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we share some similarities in Nottingham. We've got about 30% car ownership, mm-hmm. which is low for our city. There's if you've never been to Nottingham, there's about 320,000 people that live there. The wider urban area has got about 600,000 people that live there. And again, we've got high public transport usage as a result of the low car ownership, about 75 million passenger journeys a year on our bus and tram network. We were the first city in the UK, still the only city, to have implemented a workplace parking levy. Mm. For the last 10, 15 years, heavily investing in public transport, so buses and trams, trying to contain and manage congestion levels. Investing in cycling, infrastructure, behaviour change, shared transport such as car clubs. More recently, the work that I've been doing for the past 4 years has been around electric vehicle uptake. But it still doesn't feel like it's enough. I mean, our politicians came out earlier this year and said, right, Nottingham is going to, we don't have a climate emergency, because some councils are kind of jumping on that bandwagon. Ours is that we're going to be the first carbon neutral city by 2028. Mm-hmm. 2028.
It's around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, our politicians have come out. That's not the council. That's the whole city of Nottingham. Mm. That's everybody, businesses, residents, visitors, council operations. As officers, we're like, how on earth do we get there? What do we do? We've done all this stuff. Thank you, I need it. We've done all this stuff with the levy and like trying to encourage people to use the sustainable transport network. And it feels like we're just playing around at the margins. It feels like we have to do something really quite radical in transport if we're going to help to contribute to that. Like, we can't wait for new technology to bring the improvements in efficiency that will come. It will come too late. So what do? We shut the city and, you know, basically not let any cars in. You know, like Bristol came out more recently and said, right, we're going to ban diesel cars. Politically, that's a tough pill to swallow. So that impacts local people getting into jobs, businesses from being able to do what they need to do. So that's what we're grappling with on a very practical level. What type of solutions do you, on the ground, do you need to implement to make this change? Given the fact we've done a lot of stuff, we've already got like the largest electric, well, we're the first area to have the largest electric bus fleet. We've got a massive biogas bus fleet now. We're trying to electrify our own vehicles, trying to encourage businesses and residents to do the right thing as well. And it still doesn't feel like it's enough.
So, Julian, if you hear our two colleagues, which are in some ways fortunate enough to be working for a city, for a local council, where it seems the political pressure exists and the political will has been established, the targets are there. Mm. Let's say you get this phone call, help us. Could you actually help them? And so, what could you offer?
So I think at the moment, in terms of what we do, could we help them? Possibly, it depends what they want to do. So it depends if you're rolling, I mean, we could support in terms of making sure all the people in Nottingham know where all the charging points are. If you were moving to electric on the outside, if you were looking, if you were going to ban cars from the centre of the city, that I think my personal view is that would be a brilliant vision. But you've obviously got to then sell the future vision. And I think probably the main advice we give is that where we see behavioural change is selling that vision. And it is about word of mouth that we've seen in terms of, particularly where we've seen solar deployed in social housing. A lot of the time people didn't want it until their neighbours got it, and then they could suddenly afford to buy more Christmas presents. It's just giving them what is good about it and explaining why that vision is so powerful. I mean, for me, if every street in central London didn't have a car on it, life would be so much easier.
Absolutely.
And walking around a city would be a joy as opposed to trying not to get run over. So I think part of it would be looking at the behavioural psychology side and kind of researching and deeply understanding the citizens of both areas about how they want to behave and what their vision is, and can you develop a program that helps them do that? Because I think if you can get buy-in from local people, you can make some quite radical change, but it almost needs to be defined by them, and then they give you permission to move. In terms of infrastructure, my personal view is you put a solar panel on every roof you can in every city, because one, you potentially reduce heating effect anyhow, because you're using that solar for something other than heating the roof. And you're generating power and everything, and then you will generate huge behavioural change if they're getting some of that power for free or lower cost. What our experience is about 60% of people, once they put a solar panel on the roof, then invest in energy efficiency or start to just say, what they get really passionate about is not buying power from anywhere else. They try to minimise, they want to use all of theirs. And I think those hooks of painting that better future is so important in terms of being able to move mass change quickly.
Yeah. Great. I mean, it goes back to your point of being educated about what electricity is, how much you use, and that can then become very motivating if you see it on your own reading. So let's open this up. I'll take three in a row, please.
Hello. My name's Jake Thrush from Transport for West Midlands. With the Munich's decarbonisation strategy, is that heavily influenced or not really influenced by the strategy of the national government of Germany? And in turn, out of interest, is the national government of Germany's strategy, is it influenced by what the EU is thinking or what the EU might be doing in the future?
So I'm a MA design student for sustainability. So this talk was a lot about electrification and energy, which makes sense. We've got Juliet and Florent over there from energy companies. There's a big point to be made about how if every street in the UK didn't have a car on it, it would be a lot nicer to walk around, to get around. And electrification doesn't solve that. Mm-hmm. It's one thing that we definitely need to fix. We can all get around, especially in cities, using human power, which is completely renewable. And I thought that was going to be mentioned a bit more, so I'm interested to see how that works, particularly in Islington, which is where I live. I didn't cycle here today because there isn't a safe joined-up network to get here. I would have done if there was.
Yes, great. So decarbonisation beyond the car. And we have a third comment on the other side, please.
Thanks so much for your talk. My name is Lisa, and I'm not connected with the LSE. I'm an artist. So I don't know how polluting all those paints are I use. But what I'm wondering is, I just read an article in the Times today, you may have read it, some of you, that the purchase of diesel SUVs is rising very rapidly. It's far outstripping electric cars, and it's becoming a huge problem. But I haven't heard anybody address that. And I don't think you can change their behavior. Maybe I'm a bit cynical, but could measures be taken to actually stop them driving into the cities or punish them in some way? And the second thing is, what do you do with batteries when they're past their sell-by date? Thank you.
Excellent. We have three, and in fact, four really important challenges. And I think, Florian, I would like to invite you to share some insights from Munich, not least because some of those gas-guzzling machines come from your city, and you need to negotiate with BMW, a company that has a view on transport. I think there was a bit of a sentiment of, you know, let's not forget that decarbonization of transport also means maybe certain machines should no longer have the priority in our cities. So it would be interesting to hear, and just to add to these statistics on the big SUVs, the very heavy vehicles, which are so popular, not only in the US, but also in Europe. 3 weeks ago, the New York Times suggested that in almost all American cities over the last few years, we are seeing again an increase in carbon emissions only because of this type of vehicle being introduced to our roads excessively. So the combination of the question of vehicle type, consumers, what they like, and how we negotiate the interests of a major industry.
Yeah, of course, I'm not entirely neutral on that. I share your negative feelings about SUVs. I fully share them. We have the same problem in Germany, of course, more and more SUVs, a type of car which is totally insane in a city, but very popular. There are discussions in Germany, particularly in Berlin, actually to block cities for SUVs. But I'm not sure if this is the right approach, because then they will just classify them as something else and then they will come back. To be honest, Munich, the politics in Munich is very unclear, and they don't do a lot about that. They just hope that people will become sensible and switch to public transport one day. But Munich politics is not daring to really block this type of vehicles. What happens in reality is that we have traffic jams all over the day, all over the city, so the big cars block each other, basically, and that may solve the problem in the long run. When it comes to what is BMW's strategy, 1 year ago I would have known what their strategy is. If you ask me today, I don't know. I don't know. BMW was very much on a trip to new modes of transport, including public transport, becoming a mobility provider, etc. But they have officially ended that strategy and closed down this venture. So, to be honest, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they will just say, as long as people want to buy SUVs, we produce SUVs because that's where we make profits. I don't know. Coming back to the other question, is how the Munich strategy is linked to the other levels. The very simple answer is it is linked. Not 100% perfect, but there is a logical sequence from the EU target to the national targets to Munich's targets. It all is linked. And to be honest, of course, Munich's strategy would not be possible without supporting policies on the EU and the national level. As a city alone, that would not be possible.
Thank you. Now, we had a citizen from Islington. I think, Keith, you need to respond to that.
It's always a challenge when you've got one of your residents in the room, and I may have others. Number of things you said, I absolutely agree with the principle. What we are embarking on through our sustainable transport strategy, which we've been out to consultation with, but we haven't published yet, is an aspiration over the next 10 to 15 years to really develop what we're badging as low emission neighbourhoods or healthy streets. You can badge them in any way you want, but there is an initiative in London that I've implemented, a healthy streets initiative in West London, which effectively radically looks at places where people live and redesigns them for pedestrians and cyclists to be the principal mode of transport on residential streets. That takes a lot of resident engagement because people like the concept until it's in their neighbourhood. But we are likely to be launching a policy statement next year, early next year, to that effect, and some investment of how we might do it, and an aspiration that we want to do it and engage our residents in that conversation, building on models that are all over the country and in the capital as well about how that could work. And that's effectively banning through traffic in residential areas. Equally, we have another initiative that we're looking at. It goes back to the SUV point. We pioneered local taxation in terms of residents' parking permits and parking charges that charge more effectively for larger emission vehicles. And we don't apologise for that because we invest all that money in our transport infrastructure. So it's using local taxation tools and techniques to publicly say we do not like diesel vehicles and we don't like big vehicles and we will tax you, using the limited powers we have to do that. The third initiative we're working on, which combines with the other one, is a programme called School Streets. It's around school safety, around bizarre and irresponsible behaviour that parents seem to turn into strange creatures when they're trying to take their children to school, actually being quite radical about banning vehicles in streets during school, approaching school hours, both for air quality. And we are enforcing that, as well as introducing an HGV ban, which has legislatively been in place since the early 1980s, but never been enforced by anybody across the capital. We are now enforcing those bans in residential areas where lorries are using through routes, and we're piloting some technology to help us do that. We think putting those three in combination, as well as lobbying Transport for London for transport infrastructure improvements locally, in combination are forming the basis of our transport strategy.
Great, thank you. And I think there was the final point around the broader concern about batteries, the materials that go with them, and maybe let's expand that also to embedded carbon, the energy required to produce all of this. And any comments, Juliet and Rosita?
So on the battery side, there are two things we should be looking at on batteries. The first one is that when you've used a battery for movement, for transport, that battery can then be used as a stationary battery afterwards. So it has a different life cycle in different ways of using it. So when we're looking at stationary batteries that are then backing up the grid, you should always be looking to recycle them from mobility batteries. The next piece is, and I don't think we've seen enough of this yet, is I did talk to the head of the Faraday Centre, which is the main research centre on battery in the UK, to ask them how much work are they doing on recycling. Now, they're beginning to do that work, because obviously there's a lot of precious metals in batteries, and we need to start being able to look at reusing them, but it's not enough yet. So we need to make sure that, again, coming to the research, we're seeing all the government's commitment to massive increases in research budgets at the moment, and we should be directing that research to solve some of these problems. I mean, I think it's interesting that you're an artist. I think that this whole conversation about citizens, politicians, regulation, I think we need to see a movement around all of them. I don't think you can rely on one part of it, of that. I went to this brilliant conference once called Tipping Point, and there were four corners of the room that you were meant to go and stand in, and one was government, one was public and artists and journalists and writers, one was scientists, and one was industry, I think. Everybody stood in somebody else's corner. Which I always thought was quite amusing. So they all thought it was somebody else's problem to solve. And I think that we need all of those people working together. And coming back to the local pollution problem, I saw a brilliant piece of work on citizen science, where actually you gave people the ability to measure local pollution in streets, and they uploaded that data live so that you would get live monitoring of air pollution. And what you then get is people basically seeing sort of cars or the impact of particular vehicle transport. And you get this sort of a massive awareness change. And that awareness change then permits people to make change. And I think we need to take all of those people on this journey, because I think you can introduce the regulation, but wow, if you've got people behind that regulation, it's like when we banned smoking in pubs. Do you remember that? I mean, people used to smoke. I'm sort of going back to... But I remember my first job. Everybody used to smoke in the offices in the EU. I worked in the commission for a bit. And everybody smoked in their offices.
Yeah, they used to have smoking rooms, apparently.
Well, they still have them, do they?
No, they used to. Everyone would go and...
And on airplanes as well.
And
suddenly, nearly overnight, but everybody just kind of agreed that wasn't okay anymore, and we banned it, and that was it. And actually, it was, and it feels like we kind of need to create some of those tipping points on this in terms of how do you get regulation working brilliantly with consumer awareness. Mm.
Very briefly, Flory.
Yeah, a short note on the battery issue. Two thoughts. First of all, I think it's primarily the oil industry who tries to fight electric vehicles with this argument that batteries are non-ecological, etc. The fact is, it is not true anymore. There's a brand new study that came out in Germany a couple of weeks ago showing that if you look at total cost on total CO2 when producing the electric cars, etc., and running them, then even if you have an energy mix as Germany has today with only a limited amount of renewables, after 100,000 kilometers, the climate footprint, CO2 footprint of an electric vehicle is better than of a conventional vehicle. And secondly, the second thought on that is the same was true about photovoltaics for a long time. For a long time, the traditional energy industry said, and it was correct, that photovoltaics doesn't make sense at all because you need more energy to produce the thing that then it produces over all of its lifetime. So ecologically, it didn't make any sense. But, of course, there's innovation, there's improvement, and the same will be for batteries. So in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, batteries will become better and better. There will be recycling for batteries. Batteries will become organic, etc. So I'm pretty confident it would be stupid to stop that now, just bet on innovation, and that will work as it has worked for photovoltaics.
Thank you. So I see the gentleman in the back here, and then someone here in the middle.
Good evening. Thank you very much for the wonderful panel. I'm an economist at ARUP's Integrated City Planning, and actually this question is mostly to the gentleman, and sorry, the panelists from the city council side, and the question is about inclusivity. So these, all of these things that we're talking about now, I mean, some of these policies are hitting mostly poor people. And I would be really interested, like, for example, banning cars from the city centers or congestion charging schemes. They really I don't know, they're hitting mostly poor people, whereas there are other policies like densification, which are more inclusive. And I would be really interested in your thoughts, whether when you make decisions, do you take this into consideration and how?
Great, very good that we're talking about the just transition as well. And then one final question from the gentleman in the center.
Hi, thank you for your talk. So I'm David, I'm a student, undergrad student here at LSE, and I'm also the secretary of LSE Automotive Society. So just 2 days ago, we actually host a panel inviting a guy from Ubertricity, manager director from Ubertricity, who is kind of like providing charging infrastructures in UK and also in Europe. So during his panel, he mentioned a few notes that I found interesting. One is that a kind of high portion of their revenue currently comes from subsidies. So do you think like the subsidies, like if the subsidy gone away, how will the market change? And more importantly, one thing he talked about is that when doing kind of implementing, or what they do is they transform lampposts into a EV charging point. And but most of the time they said like they gather a lot of data, so like they have like a kind of an opportunity to say planning where the infrastructure point is, but because the lamppost itself belongs to the local authority, so the current like the planning decision of where to implement all the charging infrastructure is belongs to the local authority. So how do you view the kind of like the dynamic between say like the public, the private sector of providing this kind of like technical infrastructure versus like the public sector that kind of like do all those planning work?
Great, thank you very much.
Brilliant questions. I could probably give a lecture just on electric vehicle implementation and the challenges that we face. To answer the question at the back, usually the implementation and the design of our schemes is done through negotiation, so it's not a perfect solution. The social equality aspect is something that keeps coming up again and again. I've been criticised in the past in terms of, or challenged by my own politicians internally after we've won the money to say, right, why exactly are we trying to encourage people to go electric? These cars, Teslas, these cars are really expensive. Our local residents cannot afford these cars. The affordability factor is something that's out of our control. Obviously, you know, prices are set by manufacturers, taxation and grants are offered are set at the national level. What we can do is try to provide the charging infrastructure, create the environment within which these electric vehicles can actually thrive, and then also introduce electrics through other means, such as car clubs. So we're trying to take away barriers to access through other aspects. I suppose the emphasis from me at the moment on electric vehicles is because we've been doing everything else. We've been doing walking and cycling, public transport use, behaviour change to get out of cars. What we haven't really been doing intensively is trying to tackle the composition of the road transport, the makeup of our vehicles on our roads until the last 3 years or so, which is why we're trying to sort of gather pace on that front. So yeah, it's not an absolute. We have to work with different landowners, different charge point suppliers in terms of what they can offer and the return on investment. What do consumers want? When we had events 3 years ago, we had people come and say, oh, these electric cars, they'll never catch on. You know, what's the range of these then? They'll never work. They're too expensive, aren't they? And now, when you have an event, you've got people asking far more intelligent questions, saying, well, what is the real-world range of this vehicle? And I've seen the second-hand market emerging, and actually the second-hand market is thriving at the minute. The price of electric vehicles on a second-hand rate is actually appreciating. It shows that the demand is there. The problem that we have now is supply. Okay. We're not getting enough vehicles in to supply. That's one of the issues. And one of the observations that I'd like to make on the battery conversation previously was that some of the leading experts are saying that the UK, in order to facilitate this 10 million, et cetera, vehicles that we're going to have that are electric, we need a UK-based battery manufacturing plant, and we need it urgently, because if we leave it all to China, we'll be importing every single electric vehicle that will run on our road. Mm-hmm. So that's a big risk for us. Can you remind me of the question over here? Sorry.
Ubertricity.
Electricity, yes. So again, there's an equality debate around that. So if you've got off-street parking and you're relatively affluent, then you can afford an electric vehicle. So if you live in a terraced house and you've got on-street parking, well, how can you charge your electric car? In Nottingham, we're not actually implementing on-street charging, using Ubertricity or lamp columns or any other type of post for that matter, just because of practical challenges. So our street lights have deliberately been set to the back of the footway to allow for pedestrians and wheelchair users, etc., to be able to navigate the footpath. So if you're going to introduce street lighting options, then you need a secondary pillar that's at the front of the footway next to the carriageway. So therefore, you're introducing street clutter. So there's like a political sort of debate around this. Other people will have different views on it, but that's kind of what we've done at the minute. And the jury's still out. If you've got a petrol or a diesel vehicle, for the last 100 years or so, you've been in the habit of going to a petrol station or a supermarket to go and fuel your car. But with electric vehicles, it's not concluded yet, the conversation. Where do people want to charge? I have off-street parking, I can charge my car overnight. If I need an emergency charge, I can go to a rapid charge point, wherever that is. We've deployed about 350 charge points in 17 local authority areas in the last 18 months. And they're mainly at park and rides, car parks, and other strategic locations close to sort of major roads. So we're not doing the sort of residential or the housing bit. That's not to say that we shouldn't be, but then where's the developer? You know, what's the planning system like in terms of helping to facilitate all of this? It really takes a village. It doesn't take just the local authority, because it kind of comes back to who's paying for it.
All right. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we really need to bring it to a close, but I have one final question for all of our panelists. And if you then want to add another final comment to what you have picked up, please do so. So my final question for the four of you brings us back to how we started the evening, and that was around the climate emergency. And what I increasingly feel is incredibly helpful is to bring our need for actions much closer to the present. So for a city government of your choice, you can choose whatever city government you like, if that government approaches you in relation to advice how to reduce next year, in 2020, carbon emissions from the transport sector, the urban transport sector, by 15%, which is what some people would argue is exactly what we would need next year to be in line with the Paris Agreement in contexts like the UK, what would be your number one policy action you would advise this city government of your choice? Keith, let's start with you.
Thank you very much. 15% carbon reduction. I think it would be, picking up on the transport, I think it would be an accelerated policy around how we can invest in electric vehicle infrastructure and reduce taxation on electric vehicles full stop, to really drive that agenda further forward. Because I think it could be short term, it could be practical, and it builds on the fact that we've got a hybrid vehicle market developing, particularly in Uber, through Uber, where you've got hybrid technology coming through, so you're getting a second-hand market, so we need to push that.
And that would be in Islington?
I would say that would be a London-wide policy.
Okay. Mm. Your number one policy tool?
Anyone who wants to help us, I'll talk to them from a city planning local authority perspective. God, you put me on the spot there. I think I would lean on national government to make additional funding available. We're actually coming to the end of our programme. We've built up a tremendous amount of momentum, and it runs the risk of it falling off the cliff until we have continuation funding. So I've looked to national government to make and more kind of widespread funding available. We're kind of one of the lucky ones because we're in the club, but we get emails from local authorities up and down the country. Here in London, you've got the London boroughs, but then, you know, from Nottingham, 2 hours away, we'd say, well, there's London and then there's the rest of the country, and we kind of need to even out the balance in terms of investment. So yeah, I'd say national government to try and, no offence, it's not your fault, is it? It's not your fault, it's the political environment within which we exist. So definitely need more cash to keep the momentum, to keep all of this investment going.
Okay, more cash, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Juliet, 15% in 1 year.
In one year.
Yeah,
because a big infrastructure project would take longer than that, wouldn't
That's
it?
That's right.
I'm not allowed to build a big infrastructure project. Okay, so, and I think influencing government might take too long as well, because one of the worst things they've done is the road tax, because obviously they've changed the road tax, which means that electric vehicles are the same as non-electric vehicles.
Yeah.
Which was an extraordinary backtrack of where it was for previously. So that was just silly. So first of all, just reverse that very quickly, number one. I would then, so I'm going to nick Manchester, and I'm going to suggest that Manchester, it's got quite a lot of electrification already in terms of its grid. So actually, it does two things. It sort of does a zero carbon centre, so make sure that nobody can come in if they've got any carbon production at all. So it's a sort of right in the centre, you can only have electric vehicles. And they put solar panels on every roof they possibly can to power their existing electric infrastructure, and that would get you a shift very, very fast.
Excellent. And Florian?
I'm a bit more pessimistic, but I think it works. I fully agree with you that all infrastructure projects are not, you know, 1 year is too short for all sorts of infrastructure projects. And I'm also very skeptical about changing the asset base to electric vehicles, because within 1 year, the asset base is so stable and changes only gradually, even if you massively push. If everybody only buys electric vehicles, it still takes 10 and more years until the fleet is renewed. So 15% in 1 year, I think the only way that really works is to massively change the modal split, massively. And that means think about all sorts of ways how you can make life hard for vehicle drivers, everything that comes to your mind, and at the same time massively increase the number of buses, because buses, more buses is the only thing that you can do within 1 year. Even it's diesel buses, that is not something politicians want to hear, but it's a fact. If you just massively increase the number of diesel buses and reduce cars, you can make 15% in 1 year.
Great, excellent. And with this final comment, I also have a very simple task now to conclude. Bringing it back to cities, why is it that, you know, yes, we talk about urban transport, but if the decarbonization really relies on modal shift, that in turn means it relies on the spatial configuration where it allows you to actually reach destinations not only by cars. And that means that you have to, once again, take full advantage of the densities, of the mixed uses that you have in cities. Now, in addition, and this is our argument at LSE Cities always, that there is something about the city as a political sphere of operating. And it was so encouraging to hear from our two colleagues from local governments in the UK that they're almost overwhelmed by the political demands for decarbonisation and the political will. How great is that? And I think that says a lot about the progressive forces that exist in cities which we need to harness. So I would like to, of course, thank our wonderful panel, our equally wonderful guests, my colleagues Emily Cruz, Melissa Funiera, and the LSE stewards for making tonight possible. And I hope you did enjoy it as much as I did. Thank you.